Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guests for this episode are Wilson Alvarez and Ben Wise. They are permaculture teachers and practitioners from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, who focus on rewilding, observation, and tending to the wild, particularly Zone 4 permaculture. I also consider them my friends and colleagues in the local community, having learned and shared a great deal with both of them, as well as having sat down and broken bread and had meals together. This is their third time on the show, and you'll find links to those past episodes in the show notes. For this conversation, we spend much of our time talking about their advanced permaculture design course, which revolves around three core concepts: reconnection, regeneration, and rebellion. It is quite a conversation, and I look forward to having more with them around this area of expertise, around rewilding and observations, as I'm reminded of David Holmgren's suggestion that we all find our own niches, and I continue to develop my own. If you enjoy this interview or any of the past episodes, please make a donation so that I can keep things rolling along. Find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now we go to Ben and Wilson. I'll join you again afterwards with some updates. Our last conversation about your work with rewilding in Zone 4 permaculture has had a lot of impact on the listeners with feedback and interest in what you're doing and how it's gotten them to think differently about Zone 4 and our role as designers and making change in the world that honors both the human space and the wild. From that, I'd just like to continue that conversation to learn more about your work and the advanced PDC that you're teaching and how that impacts your development of your rewilding school and the other projects that you're involved in.
So we're teaching an advanced permaculture course that we've branded Wild Permaculture because it's a nice catchy title. But it's essentially about permaculture for Zone 4 and to a certain extent Zone 5. So semi-wild land management, and also beyond just land management or you know, interaction with ecology, looking at Zone 4, you know, as the boundary of not only physical human culture, but also, or I should say, not only physical, you know, our civilization, but also our culture. So Zone 4 being sort of the boundaries of thought, the boundaries of knowledge, the fringe of culture, places where creativity springs forth from the unknown. I personally am fascinated with the way that marginal lands and marginal ecosystems syncretize with marginal people and marginal ideas. So that's sort of the fodder for the curriculum of our class, which I'm really grateful to be teaching this class. It's full, it's really well attended, people are really excited about it, and it's really helping Wilson and I to systematize a lot of the information that we've been gathering and generating over the last half decade to get ready to write our book. Again, as I've said in other interviews with you, Scott, the foundation of the curriculum for the class, which is, again, the foundation really of our work, is all about observation practice and this constant re-emphasizing that permaculture as an applied science doesn't work without a continued observation practice. So that's where we're starting with our students. The first half of the class is all about learning various different ways to observe Zone 4, both as a physical and a cultural and ideological place. And then the second half of the class is all about learning how to begin to design in Zone 4. And again, not only the physical Zone 4, but also the cultural Zone 4.
So the way we started sort of thinking about sort of rewilding and Zone 4 permaculture is that three-tier sort of triangle that we came up with is reconnect to the land, regenerate the land, and rebel against the culture. And those three are independent, yet they work together, and each one is sort of a, just think of it as a tripod. Any of those come off, the whole thing falls apart. So reconnect. The first principle of permaculture is to observe and interact. We can write whole books on just observation, and our whole class, so it's an 8-month class, first 4 months, just observation techniques. As designers and as people, and for me, coming from a sort of rewilding primitive skills background, I've taken awareness and observation sort of out of the, what I was telling Ben the other day, out of the realm of the five senses. and moved it past that sort of to internal observations. What am I feeling like? How does that affect my external observations and emotional observations? And how am I feeling? How does this thing make me feel? And then even further, even going out beyond that, how we've broken the class and how we're doing this and how we're like approaching observation is foundational. So how do you use your senses? We all have these dulled senses from living in cities and living inside of houses and not sort of being part of the world. So when you're talking about designing, you can't design something that you don't know or understand. I think for us to observe first and interact, I think it was Bruce Lee that said, knowledge without application is worthless, right? So what's the point of having knowledge without applying it? So getting people to observe what's actually happening in front of them. And then after that, that's the only way that you can actually move toward the design process. So like Ben was saying, it's half and half. But it's really what it is, it ends up being 8 months of observation and 4 months of design work, because they end up continuing their observation techniques the entire time. And me and Ben were just talking about how could we teach a year long based on this. And it would be, you know, first 4 months would be observation techniques. So they end up doing it for the whole year. And then on month four, we start doing regeneration techniques. So they get 8 months of that. And then the last 4 months would be introduction to rebellion. So different types of activism and different types of thing. So they get 4 months of that. And you're basing it sort of on foundational all the way up. You know, it breaks the class up really well through observation and through the type of things that sort of we're sort of pushing the boundaries, and especially the class that we're coming up with now that we're calling sacred observation. We're really pushing the boundaries as to sort of what's safe to talk about, what should be talked about, and how do we talk about it. And me and Ben we sat for a couple of hours now, sort of, what's the best way? You know, I asked a couple people in the class, are you going to feel comfortable if I talk about this or not? And yet through all that, you know, it doesn't matter if you're comfortable or not. And it might be even better if you're not comfortable, because I really need to get the information out there. It doesn't matter sort of from what foundation you come, religious, non-religious, spiritual, non-spiritual. Observation is just a technique. And we've been trying to put it in some sort of palatable way that someone who comes from religious background and someone who comes from a sort of atheist scientific background, everyone can swallow it. Because that's the most important thing. The technique is more important than the semantics of it. I think that's where we're headed. And I think that's, we've seen that that's so important that we sort of have no choice. It takes way longer than that. I've literally been 10 years of doing observation, and every day I observe something new, or I figure out a new way to see something, or something interacts with something else that I've learned, and then this network is created, and all of a sudden I see things in a whole different way. So it's a lifelong process, but I'm sort of foundational. When we started thinking about this advanced class, we were like, well, how are we going to teach observation in 4 months? Well, we're not. We're just teaching them foundational things, and they're going to spend the rest of their lives doing it.
It's one of those things when I was talking with Natasha that it seems so simple when we break it down, but then realizing the amount of time that we've spent to get to the places where we are to be able to do the things that we need to do. They are these long pursuits. We take that first step and it seems to open our eyes and we go, I can see now for the first time. And then 5 years later, you look back and you go, I didn't really see then, I just happened to be able to see something, and it continues to grow and change with you. Now, with your course, it's an advanced PDC and there are 23 students in it. Did you require that everyone have a permaculture design certificate in order to take the course?
Yeah, we did set that as a prerequisite. We also, you know, in the course details, we would be willing to make an exception for someone who could demonstrate, you know, certain life experience or learning that would allow them to be participating in an advanced PDC. And the reason we did that is because we wanted to make sure that there was a vocabulary that had already been established so that we didn't have to spend time in class going back all the time constantly and reiterating and re-explaining the basic ideas of permaculture and the basic ideas of ecology. You know, listening to what Wilson was saying about sort of the development of our curriculum, it made me realize, I'd like to put this out there, that what you all are listening to right now is essentially a conversation that demonstrates our process of developing this idea of wild permaculture, permaculture for zones 4 and 5. And I'm really appreciative to be participating in this process. And I'm also really appreciative of the people who've come before us in the permaculture movement who've established this tradition in permaculture as an applied science of constantly checking, rechecking, examining, re-examining, and evolving the system forward. You know, on the front cover of David Holmgren's great book, Permaculture Principles and Pathways, he's got his permaculture flower design, and weaving through that flower is this spiral, which if you read his explanation of what that design is, he says that the spiral weaving through this flower, which represents permaculture as a science, is a reminder to us that permaculture as an applied science has to continually adapt to be applicable, to be useful to whatever's going on. And so I can't sit here and claim that we've developed the entire system of what wild permaculture is and looks like. For example, Wilson mentioned several times these sort of three ethics of wild permaculture that we've been developing, which he gave me credit for, but he came up with them and they're wonderful. And I've been working with them and, you know, adding something back to the mix. And he articulates them as, you know, a reconnection to the land or to the wild, a regeneration of the wild systems, and a rebellion of the destructive culture. I personally prefer to use the word rejection, and that's okay, but it is definitely, I want to make sure that everyone understands, we are talking about a rejection of the culture of oppression and destruction that has caused the separation between modern humans and the spirit of the wild, that the first of those three ethics, reconnection, is offering a solution to. Another thing that I'd like to throw out here about the sort of development of this conceptual framework for wild permaculture, which again, essentially permaculture is just a conceptual framework, a tool for us to, you know, to organize our thoughts and our understandings and our information. We're working on 6 new principles of permaculture design that complement David Holmgren's, but that are very much about developing a culture that lends itself to reconnection and regeneration and that rejection of the oppressive, destructive culture. I'm not prepared at this time to articulate all 6 of those principles, but, you know, in the near future, they will be worded in a way that they'll be ready to be taught. And, you know, to go back talking about how this class that we're teaching is, I'm just so glad to be involved in it because it's, again, allowing me and forcing me really to get this stuff down and to get it ready to be taught and to be offered. And lastly, I just want to hit on what Wilson said about, you know, being a little bit uncomfortable and tie that back in with what I said earlier in this interview about zone 4, not only being the margin of our human ecosystem, but also the margins of culture and the margins of thought and the margins of understanding. That is uncomfortable. You know, humans historically are afraid of the unknown. And the fact that we are being pushed to develop a system that allows us to reconnect, regenerate, and reject, it demonstrates, you know, this discomfort. It demonstrates this place of not knowing. And we are, along with our students, moving through this process of checking the edges. What's out there? What's out there? You know, when I go out into the woods on the edge of my city, it's a little nerve-wracking sometimes. There are homeless people out there. I have been threatened before. I've found evidence of crime. Those marginalized ecosystems are dangerous to go into. And, you know, Wilson was talking about the sort of spiritual dimensions of observation work. For a lot of modern people, those are also dangerous places to go because we have a fragile psyche in the modern world. And going out and exploring methods of observation that are not supposed to even really work, that can be dangerous and frightening, that is where we're going with this work. And not everything that we develop will be correct or complete. And that's another beautiful part of the work that we're doing, is that we're constantly challenging ourselves to surround ourselves with the community of permaculture practitioners who are willing to take this science beyond where it has already gone.
There's one big part, that rejection or rebellion part, is how do you practice permaculture in the age of collapse? You know, how do you practice permaculture at the age of peak oil or the age of environmental collapse? Do you continue to just focus on techniques, or do you continue to, what do you do? And that's why it has spawned me to, and men, to really focus on the wildlands, the places that are not completely pigeonholed into a human-based system and still have sort of the, not only do they have a wildness, they have answers out there. There's answers out there that, you know, that's what Zone 5 is all about, right? Leaving it and learning from it. And just because it's a Zone 4 doesn't mean it doesn't act as Zone 5 as far as giving information to you. It's reciprocal. Zone 4 is very reciprocal in that you can't only give, you can receive from it. So this is the age of collapse, whether you want to say it or not, or you believe it or not. I mean, we are living in an age where we're right on the precipice of too much CO2 and the Greenland is melting. I just watched a whole documentary on the Greenland ice sheet is melting. And if that happens, God knows what, the CO2 levels are higher than they've been in 250,000 years. And the only thing that gives me hope is permaculture. The only thing that frustrates me the most is permaculture, because it doesn't take us anywhere. It's just like where, how is being taught, what it is doing, and how it's being applied doesn't go even close to as far as I think it could, and it doesn't help as much as I think it could. So this is practicing permaculture in the age of collapse. This is what it looks like. And I think this is our personal response to not being scared and not being frightened and not being pigeonholed into saying, I teach permaculture, so I teach it this way. No, I teach permaculture and I want to be able to apply it this way. So how do I do that? That's where I'm coming from. I think it's where the project is coming from too. It's just like, what do we do? What makes us feel? I feel best when I'm in the woods and I'm being surrounded and I have a communication with the land itself, not isolated in my house by myself. I don't feel very good doing that. So just applying that and saying, how can this affect more people and more animals and more plants? So that's what it is for me.
How would you describe rewilding, both from a practical, like techniques kind of standpoint, but larger to those principles and ethics and how they apply to people?
If you go and Google rewilding, you're going to get two different things. You're going to get, there's a, started by Dave Foreman, the Rewilding Institute, which is this big push in the conservation biology to sort of bring megafauna back to America, to bring elephants and lions and cheetahs back to which they were here before. Just some of them have been gone only less than, 6,000 to 8,000 years. So they say that the Rewilding Institute and the rewilding sort of conservation movement says elephants, especially now, they're being killed for their ivory like crazy in Africa. We have huge parts of Kansas that are completely like the savannah. Elephants have done well here. They will do well here. Let's bring them over here. We don't even need to create habitats for them. They'll do just fine here. We have the American antelope, which runs at 70 miles an hour. It's the fastest animal other than the cheetah, which, why did it grow so fast? Because we had the American cheetah here, and that was its number one. So bringing a cheetah here wouldn't be out of the question. So that's the one. When you go Google rewilding, you're going to get the conservation rewilding idea of moving megafauna to places that they can either fill a niche that they've already filled or could fill a niche of an extinct species that has gone extinct for one or more reasons. The second one that you'll see is sort of the anarchist rewilding, which is the undomestication of humanity and the undomestication of land. So in anarchist rewilding, they'll look at a city and see it as just subjugated land. They'll even see farms as subjugated soil. The soil is being left to a certain pH and a certain thing. Well, if we walked away, the pH would change and trees would grow and, roots would grow and be really different. When I am saying rewilding, I am mixing those two. I am using it in an anarchist way, and I'm also using it in a conservation biology way, because what we're doing with the Rewilding Project, the Rewilding School, and the idea of restoring Eden is both of those things. We're saying we must undomesticate ourselves. And what is domestication? I mean, if we think of domesticated animals, we think of a cow or a chicken or something. But I mean, if you go to Hawaii, you have wild cattle, which are domesticated cattle that were dropped off there in the 1800s. So when sailors would come back, they would have something to eat. You have wild lamb, wild sheep. So these things have gone what they call feral. They are animals who were previously domesticated, who have now become wild. And plants are very similar like that. They can go sort of feral. So a lot of what I'm talking about as far as rewilding is that the idea of undomesticating our thought processes so we don't think like everyone else, opening yourself back up, rewilding yourself, letting sort of information come from all different places, very much like a wild plant has to put deep roots in order to get nutrients from different places. And also the idea of we have a sick landscapes. We have things that are missing. We have huge gaps, and you can see it, especially on the edges of cities or the edges of towns or the edges of cornfields. You'll see these sort of islands that are can't even walk through them. The brambles are so big, or the vines are so large. But the idea of bringing in sort of maybe things that might not belong there, quote unquote, but things that would fill a niche and be multi-use. That might be useful for humans, might be useful for animals and deer at the same time, might be a nitrogen fixer, all that. So I think as far as the rewilding school, or what I'm seeing with rewilding, is a really good mix of when you go Google rewilding, I think it's sort of a good mix of both of them. It's the hands-on approach of reconnection, which the anarchist rewilding is, and the conservation biologist regeneration part.
When you're looking at rewilding, this is a reconnecting human beings with nature, and getting us so that we can observe in a more natural way, to think in a more natural way. I don't actually know how to define natural right now, but to remove us from the current culture so that we can be in a place where we can see, think, and do in a more human appropriate manner. That it's not this, okay, well, I got to be here at this time, this constant consumer culture push. Let's take a step back from all that and find ourselves in this and the wild.
And what does it take to be a human in this world? And what is a human? I mean, it's so simple to say a human is a person, but you know, what is it to be a human being in this world? I mean, I think there's a big difference. Are we put here for a reason? Do we have self-will? All that type of like sort of, what does that mean? What does life for a sort of hunter-gatherer, does their worldview look very different from ours? Of course. And all that is based on when we surround ourselves with permanent things, right? We surround ourselves with things that we've created ourselves. If I go out of my little house right now, I'm surrounded by trees that were planted by human beings, grass, and I'm surrounded by houses, these super permanent things, and none of it comes from sort of the landscape. Everything was put here by human beings. Well, my psyche is based on these things that I've grown up with and getting in a car and doing all these things. Even though we're all biologically human beings, I am a very different species than a person who was born in a wigwam and hunted and gathered for all their food and did all this thing. We see the world in a very different way. And I mean, in The Forest People, it's a really great book by Colin Turnbull. He actually took a pygmy from the forest and he took him out to the savannah. And the first thing that the pygmy saw was a water buffalo. And he was so scared. And he said, why is that water buffalo so small? Because when you live in a forest, perspective is one of those things that's very hard because you can't see but 20 feet in front of you. So in his whole life, he had never seen farther than 20, 30 feet in front of him. So when he saw this buffalo a mile away or quarter mile away, he had no frame of reference for understanding that that's just, it's farther away, so it's smaller. So that's really something really simple, but it's a way of saying that I can't see the world in a way. So why does rebellion have anything, what does rebellion or rejection have anything to do with the reconnection and permaculture in general? You can't reconnect to land that's being destroyed by your culture. You would always have to come back to the questioning of why is this happening? And I think people who are getting into permaculture have already asked that question to begin with. I think we're just trying to create these sort of foundational things that they can say, okay, I know I've felt this way, but what can I do about it? And that's sort of where the other two parts of it come in.
For our advanced PDC, Wilson developed this great graphic that illustrates how in order for a culture to be sustainable, for a group of people to live in a sustainable way, they have to rely heavily on non-human infrastructure. In fact, the more human infrastructure we create, the more of a gamble we're taking, essentially, with our culture, the more fragile we make it. You know, to expand on that and this idea of rewilding and, you know, what that means, I keep coming back to Gregory Cahete's book, Native Science. And he talks in that book about how part of sort of the ecological understanding of native peoples is this constant and pervasive incorporation into culture and daily life of ritual, metaphor, storytelling, art, and ways of livelihood that remind us all the time of the source of our infrastructure, the source of the things that we need to live. But in our modern culture, we don't have those reminders. So from a design perspective, permaculture-wise, by having more wild land, healthier wild land, and finding ways of constantly increasing the amount of wild and renewable resources that our society relies on, we begin to rebuild these small, pervasive daily reminders of what it is that's the source of our sustenance. And, you know, there's nothing unscientific about this. I don't want to get like off into, you know, la la land here, but people do not take care of things unless they appreciate them. And just to use some basic emotions like love, part of rewilding is teaching people how to love the earth, because we need to take care of the earth in order to survive. And people do not take care of something that they don't appreciate, that they don't have reverence for, that they don't respect. And people don't respect things, people don't love things unless they have a certain level of understanding for them. And right now there's very little understanding of ecology and wild land, and it's far removed from modern people. And so this middle ground between civilized, domesticated life and rewilding is, I think, what Will and I were talking about in our last interview, showing people that there are all manner of different types of basic value in wild systems being close at hand, being actively participated with.
Speaking about caring for the things that we know, or needing to know about things in order to care for them, I think about where I live. There's a cold water stream that runs behind my house. I get to watch the herons fish there. But there's a connection there that if they disappeared, my life would be less for it. And that I wouldn't be able to teach my children about them, or to tell them how much that big bird doesn't weigh in order to fly, and how that becomes a lesson about birds and the natural world. So that then later when I talk to them and we're passing a group of turkey buzzards sitting next to the roadside, I can tell them, you know that big bird that you see in the stream? Those birds weigh even less than that does. Then we can use that as a lesson to count the birds. And it's like, well, you know, that entire group of birds weighs less than you do. And it really makes a difference in the way that we're able to interact with the world and the good that we can do by having that connection.
The idea of going out and looking at the land and seeing what it is, that's exactly what we're talking about with all these wildlands. You know, it's the same exact thing that we're talking about, that type of connection. Same connection you have with your wife, same connection you have with your children, that love that you have, that's a type of love. That's a type of understanding. It's a type of relationship that we're going to need, whether we live in a city or we live in, regardless of where you live, the wildlands are still the most important thing. It's they're where all the nutrients come from, where the oxygen comes from, where the water system comes from. So no matter if you don't really interact with Zone 4 or Zone 5 on your daily basis, that's why you're breathing right now. That's why you're drinking water right now, because these wild systems exist. There are no human systems that can take over for them. So in order for the constant abuse of them is what's having our water being more and more polluted and our oxygen being less and less and the CO2 levels rising. All that stuff is because of we can't see it, right? The idea that what we can't see, we can't take care of, and what we don't love, we won't take care of either. The idea of having no choice but to be able to go outside and make a connection with this, because we don't have that much time. We don't have that much time to be like, oh, I'm going to, let's wait for the scientists to come up with something. I mean, it's scary and it's dangerous. And at this point, I kept saying the idea of collapse. We're on so many different types of collapse scales, like the fisheries and the water, and especially where we are, the fracking has gotten really out of control, and there doesn't seem to be any help coming from anywhere, especially the government or any other places. You know, we're left to ourselves, by ourselves, for ourselves. So where do we go from here? if we don't reconnect to each other, reconnect to our land base, we won't protect it. And I'm not going to protect you if you're not going to protect me. And it's sort of that same exact reciprocal relationship that we need to create with non-human beings. And that's very like, well, how can you make a relationship with a non-human being or a non-sentient being or like, you know, something that doesn't breathe like a rock or a stream? But you can. I mean, people have done it over and over and over again. It's just, I think you just have to, we teach in the class the idea of bias. Bias is the biggest filter for your perceptive world, for the perceptive world. The more biased you become, you're not able to have things come in. Just think of yourself as a cone that's been closed off. Nothing can come in because you've already filled it. Every niche is already filled in your book. So the less bias that you have, the more you can actually observe the world correctly. You just open it up. And I think that's where sort of that internal observation is so damn important to getting and actually seeing the world for what it is. We are looking at the world through dulled senses to begin with. We only have 5 not that good senses. We can't smell like a hound dog. We can't see like an eagle. We can't do anything. But what we have, we've already dulled. So what type of world are we perceiving? Is it real? The idea of transcending the sensory world, the 5 senses, and seeing the world for what it is. I don't know if we can do that if we don't have a relationship.
Taking Ben's choice of the word rejection, the way that I kind of just internalized all that is that it's about rejecting a culture of scarcity and hate, if you will, so that we can instead embrace a culture of love and abundance. That scarcity is one of those things that seems to divide us. You know, we have to hoard this, we have to hoard that. But at least from my own personal path with all this, the more that I do this, the more that I give away from it, the more connections that are made, the more life I get to live as a result of this practice. It's not a matter of counting days or years until this happens or that happens. As I was talking with Natasha, that idea of living an authentic life. You get to wake up every morning caring about what it is you do, and you can be more peaceful and loving in the world because you're not all stressed out or tweaked or hateful about things. Ben, when you walked in and you asked me how I was doing, and I just laughed out loud about it because it was, for a moment, I wanted to give that normal answer of, well, everything's okay. But then there was a space there where we could communicate and be open to who we are as people and what's going on in our lives, and reinforces that connection and what we can do to do more, to do better.
For me, the idea of opening yourself up for observation of any kind and awareness of any kind. So it's not all nice, right? What's happening in the world isn't nice and it isn't fun. So it's really easy to be like, I don't want to think about that. I'm stressed out as it is. My job sucks or this. So I can't think about what's happening to the fish. It's so far away from me, but it's not. The more you ignore, the worse it gets. And that's what we are as a people. We need to open our eyes. That's the idea of observing, right? We need to open our eyes to what is actually happening. We can't mourn for what we don't know we've lost. The more you know, the more you'll fight. And you have no choice. When you actually see 200 species a day go extinct and people are starving to death, there's sex trafficking happening all over the world. Is that part of permaculture? Hell yes, that's part of permaculture. That's part of being a human being, so it's part of permaculture, right? It's the important thing that we can't keep creating systems that hold up a system that's not working for us. Why are we acting like we can just continue keeping the lights on? And every time that light is on, something is suffering for that. There might be a land base that's suffering for that. That might be running off coal right now. That's running off the river maybe, and the river is suffering. Everything we do has a consequence. It's invisible, right? So we can't see it. So it's easy. It's invisible suffering. The idea of zone 4 is getting rid of all those in-betweens where suffering can happen and say, I am connecting to a land base and this land base is going to give me something and I'm going to be reciprocal about it. Where in our culture, even if it's organic farming or it's this, it still takes all these miles to get this and do this, and something is always being hurt in the process. There's all this suffering in between me and my food source or me and my community or me or anything. I think we're smarter than we think, and I think we're more compassionate than we act. And I think we could, especially using this sort of restoring Eden and getting back to the land, we could become truly sustainable, truly regenerative by, you know, cutting all that middleman, cutting all that out, and like going to talk to a human being or going into the woods and actually, you know, having a relationship. The idea of cutting the suffering off. What is your happiness worth the suffering of others? If it's not, if you don't feel good about that, then you need to say, then where can I stop the suffering here or there? And that's the sort of the rebellion, rejection part of this whole thing, is if I'm not reconnecting, if I'm not becoming positive, then I'm doing negative. It just is. The act of living in this world, driving your car and doing that, causes suffering for others, land bases, ecology, all of it.
And I say this just because he's quotable, but what Larry Santoyo said is, your handprint bigger than your footprint? And every day, are we able to make decisions that decrease suffering, create a more peaceful and loving world? And ultimately, we all have to make those decisions in our own way. I would like it if I could just flip a switch, wave a wand, and allow permaculture to be as big and as broad and as effective as all of our conversations and discussions and figuring out how these different pieces work make it seem like it could be. But as long as we're all doing our work, we're moving somewhere, and all of us will do that at our own speed. And it's, for me, some of my own ignorance in order to remain hopeful is taking a multi-generational approach. I know what my society and culture gave me. I operate from a particular place. I want to make sure that my children do better so that the world is better by the time my grandchildren are born. But yeah, we all have to answer our own questions and find why we do these things.
One other piece that I'd like to bring to this conversation is this. You just, you know, a few moments ago, Scott, were trying to sort of articulate your understanding of Will's, you know, principle of rebellion or rejection. And you said something about it being a rejection of the culture of hate. And I agree with that. I certainly don't disagree with that. However, I think for me, the biggest bit of that rejection, if I could point my finger at one attribute of the modern human being, the essence of a modern human being as part of our global culture that I would like to reject, it's this kind of coldness or separateness from the world, and this belief, which is a false belief and a very dangerous and damaging belief, that the world is not alive. In almost every mystical tradition and throughout, you know, the global pantheon of indigenous cultures, there is an active seeking to establish what is often referred to as a sense of wonder. And our culture does a very, very poor job of establishing a sense of wonder. And in fact, you know, we actually do a really, here in the US, we do a really bizarre thing with our children, where when they're little, we actually encourage a sense of wonder. Like, small children are supposed to participate in art and play games and tell stories and have an imagination and play with their friends and spend hours and hours and hours in the yard or on the sidewalk, you know, playing games. But when children start getting about into middle school, the curriculum changes, becomes extremely mechanical, mathematical, technical, and production oriented. And we actually begin to discourage creativity and the sense of wonder, because people are supposed to fit in, and they're supposed to fit into production. They're supposed to fit into the system of extracting resources and funneling wealth to the people who already have it. And to a certain extent, like, it makes sense, right? Because the people in power want their peons to have a certain amount of creativity, right? Because that's where ingenuity comes from, and that's where our new technologies arise from, but only to a certain extent. And in the permaculture world, you know, in a lot of the interviews on your show, there's been a dialogue that I think is very, very valid about making permaculture more of a legitimate science. And I completely agree with that. But I also think that in the permaculture movement, there's a problem. And the problem is that we claim that permaculture is derived from indigenous wisdom, but by and large, the permaculture movement rejects the piece of indigenous culture that is all about the sense of wonder, reveling in the unknown, and the livingness of the world. And there's only one person in the permaculture movement who has very actively put that part of, you know, indigenous wisdom at the forefront of permaculture, and it's Starhawk. But she also gets this sort of, she gets like a pass. You know, a lot of permaculturists are like, yeah, Starhawk's great. You know, she has this long career of writing these books that have made huge positive social changes. And so she's sort of like allowed to do this kind of like mystical living world thing. But mostly in the permaculture movement, that's frowned upon. And I would like to see us find a way to actively move forward as a science while also bringing forward this, frankly, methodology that was pervasive all around the world in indigenous societies of finding and understanding the aliveness of the world and using that as this constant reminder to reconnect and also as a method for obtaining information about how to live well and how to live correctly. And those are things, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, those are things like shamanism and magic and vision quests and all names that, you know, are just taboo in the scientific world. But if we would open ourselves, you know, and take off some of those lenses of bias, like Wilson was saying, there are people in the scientific world now who have done a lot to legitimize some of those methodologies, but even those people are ostracized. And I'm going to throw out like the HeartMath Institute or Stephen Buhner, who you had on your show earlier. There's a book that Wilson and I both love called Aboriginal Men of High Degree. And it's written by a guy named A.P. Elkin. He was an anthropologist, you know, 75 years ago. And when he went and observed Native people, he didn't say, okay, you know, they are able to do this thing that most other people would consider supernatural, but here's the scientific explanation for it. He was just like, no, these Aboriginal indigenous shamans are doing things that are not supposed to be possible. And I don't know why, but I'm watching them happen. There's a whole cadre, there's a whole slew of scientists, modern scientists, who have tried to do that unbiasedly, legitimize some of these things, and have just been sort of struck from the record. I would like to see that come forward in permaculture, and I would like to see a rejection of the idea that the world isn't alive and that it doesn't have a voice with which it tells us how to live well. That's going to be a huge piece of my career as a permaculturist.
We've gone a variety of places where I didn't know where we would end. And just one last thought that I have with what you were sharing about this idea of the native knowledge and all these other things that we should be integrating into our practice. I might not understand all of those ideas in the same way that you do, but from some of my academic pursuits, it's about how within education, there's more to it than just the three R's. That there's a narrative that goes with it, that there's a storytelling, there's something that comes with that sense of place. And as we talk within permaculture about honoring both the scientific side and the native knowledge side, there still winds up being a binary there. And that trying to find a place where those two pieces can have a dialogue and we as permaculture practitioners can exist within that is an important discussion for us to continue on sometime because there's a lot of value there. And people feeling like cogs in the machines and things. It can be easy to be rejected by society, by people, by all these different things that further divides us from who we are because we have to fill someone else's story. And I think about how important storytelling is to education. With my children, you know, I'm telling them stories about things, we're making up games. But yeah, there's that point where there's this switch and it's, well, what are you going to do when you grow up? I don't want to ask my kids that. I don't want them to start to think about where they're going to be or what they're going to do. Because I thought I knew what that was going to be, but then someone else had me be a part of their story. So I followed the path that they had set out and went through all this stuff before I finally found like this road that I wanted to be on. And just being able to honor and respect other people and where their information comes from and how they interact with the world. Because we all have different ways to describe our experience as human beings that informs our position and the way that we're able to interact with others. And I'm concerned that society and this culture that we exist in is taking these pieces that are so important to the human condition and turning them into something that doesn't give back to us. That we turn storytelling into something that needs to be humorous or entertaining. That art has to have some kind of a value. So many of these things that we value as people in our interactions, that it has to have something that we can prescribe a dollar value to, and how much entertainment fills all these different things that we used to get from our friends and family. I think about a cookout that my grandmother used to hold before she passed, where the family would get together, all the musicians would bring their instruments, the storytellers would be there. You know, everybody, I think, has that one uncle who tells dirty jokes that he shouldn't to kids. But I mean, there are these traditions and these pieces that come together. And before my grandmother died, I sat down with her and interviewed her. And through that, in asking questions, she started telling me stories about her life. And I was able to understand how this woman growing up in 1930s West Virginia, her and her family and everyone else around them were so poor, they couldn't care less about the Jim Crow laws or race or anything else, because if anybody did that, they would all fail. But that stuck with her as an adult, so she always warmly welcomed everyone. And that is now a part of who I am and something that I teach to my children. And in order to, you know, take care of these things, we need to know these stories. We need to hear these stories. And I think about, you know, the natural world and caring about it, we can sit and we can tell stories about the places we've been, the things that we've seen. Our own personal experience matters. Stephen Herod Buhner talked about that. You know, that idea of a citizen scientist, that we as people have to honor ourselves and our own experience, and how that can then move towards having a better understanding of the natural world. Telling stories about what our experiences are like, whether or not we can explain them, it doesn't matter. It's the stories, and then the way that those stories build the social connections and build culture and return these things of value to us as people and human beings, and breaks that paradigm and helps us be a little less domesticated and to see and connect and do more. But thank you both for the space that we've had today. I realize that I kind of end with a monologue there, but it's just all the thoughts and places that you've been able to take me today, and the beauty and wonderment for me in the difference of our positions and the people that we are, and what I can value in each of you, and what I take of value from this experience that you've given to me. So thank you both very much for our time again.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, thank you a lot.
And that was Ben Wise and Wilson Alvarez. With how I ended the conversation with them, that little rant of mine, I think it was enough and have no more notes to include here. However, I will be visiting Wilson, Ben, and Natasha again in about a week and a half after the release of this show. So if you have any additional questions for them, please let me know. If you'd like to contact Wilson directly, his email address is rebelgardentools@gmail.com, or Ben is susk permaculture@yahoo.com. As always, you can contact me by phone, which is the quickest and easiest way, by giving me a call, 717-827-6266, or send me an email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. You can join in the discussions with the community at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or follow me on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. From here, next week continues the series on faith and earth care when Kelly Ware joins me for a piece we're calling Permaculture and the Kingdom, which is a conversation about bridging the gap between permaculture and Christian faith communities. After that will be Dr. John Kitsteiner, who joins me to talk about permaculture and our health. He's also speaking at the Permaculture Voices Conference coming up in early March. So if you're heading to that event, look for him and say hello for me. Some updates from me. I'll be attending the A Gathering of Farmers Conference on March 8th, 2014 at Wilson College in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. If you're in the area, please consider attending, and maybe we'll get a chance to say hello to one another and sit and chat about permaculture. For that event, the keynote speaker is Brian Snyder, the executive director of PASA, the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture. Entertainment will be provided by Reverend Billy and the Stop Shopping Choir, and they're also planning a series of workshops and lectures. It should be a good time, and I'm quite looking forward to it. I'm also going to be a guest instructor at Wilson and Ben's next permaculture design course. I don't know when you'll get this, but as I'm recording this intro and ending, there are still several seats left in the class. So contact Ben for more information if you'd like to attend and are in the Central Pennsylvania area. As this episode draws to a close, can you do two things for me? If you know anyone interested in permaculture, share this show with them by emailing them a link or leave a comment on your favorite blog or website. Two, leave a review on iTunes or on whatever service you download this show from. Both those things really help to get the word out. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And that little bit of legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share this show with whoever you like. Just tell them where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.